Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode number 65 for April 8th, 2010, Wraparound Gaming. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Ryan Schrout, joined once again by Colleen. We're going to take you through a week's worth of hardware technology news and information, kind of what's going around, what's interesting to talk about, if nothing else. We would be remiss if we didn't at least mention off the top of the show how wonderful the iPad is and how everybody should buy a dozen, right?
I don't think that's exactly where we were going with this, is the commentary on the... I think you're getting enough of that, but I think we might want to talk about the significance of the hardware inside of it.
Okay, yeah, you brought up an interesting point during our pre-show chatter discussing how people got a underpowered computer in their hands with a shiny screen and a silver back. And I do want to say that I was disgusted to see, not disgust, that's the wrong word. It embarrassed me to no end to go into an Apple store with a friend who was buying his iPad. And when we left, there were people trying, like Apple employees trying to give us high fives. I thought that was awkward because I didn't give the guy a high five. I just kept walking, left him hanging. No lie. But people essentially left with a underpowered computer with a nice screen, good user interface, and now they're talking about what a great multimedia device this is. And you mentioned before the show,
and it is,
that why is that though? Is it because it is a specific device aimed at a very specific audience with a very specific purpose?
Well, first off, I think that it's proof that software is the second half of all multimedia equations, right? So, it's not, you know, we talk about horsepower, you know, you get a 3.2 gigahertz Nehalem chip that, you know, has four cores, and this is required for your, you know, Blu-ray movies and your, you know, video games and this and that. You can build really awesome applications and software that's pretty and immersive and responsive if you write the software with the hardware in mind. And, you know, it's a ARM chip that runs at 1 gigahertz. It's the A4 chip, which is, you know, whatever. It's just like any other ARM chip, right? And the games look okay. They look, you know, they don't look like PCs, but they look like, you know, a PSP, which is sweet.
Right. The example is, well, I have to admit I haven't played any of the 3D games yet because it's the phone mentality versus the PC mentality. I refuse to pay $15 for a game on my iPad, really, especially since you can't demo it beforehand. If you don't like it, you're just kind of stuck with that type of purchase. But like I saw Leo playing Plants vs. Zombies a lot on screen. That's one I really like.
Trust me, he does it while on screen without the game being on screen. So like at the end of Lost, he's sitting there looking down the whole time. It's because he's playing Plants vs. Zombies.
It's a great game. I can't fault him for it. But you're right.
You know, at the same time, the thing is, everyone says, oh, this is an amazing multimedia device. And when you touch it, it's really, really responsive. And it's just because they made really good use of the hardware that they're utilizing.
That's always been the case, though. That's kind of always been Apple's mantra, right? Is that,
well, I think with their mobile devices, but I don't think that their desktops are.
People liked their desktops before. If we go back and we look before the Intel days, right, when software had to be specifically written for the Apple versus the PC market, the applications that did come out for the Mac were written specifically for it, and thus went through a better tuning process than they could on the PC because of how locked down the hardware is. You knew exactly what you were working with. You could set higher system requirements than you would on the PC because Mac users tended to either upgrade frequently, and or if they didn't, they were used to the fact that Apple or some other software developers say, sorry, you can't use this software anymore. You have to upgrade your hardware in order to do it. So I feel like the iPhone and the iPad are kind of an extension of that.
But it's really cool. I mean, if you think about it, that it's a mobile ARM processor that gets 12 hours of battery life in a package that's light, has a beautiful screen, IPS panel, and has a capacitive touch interface. I mean, that's just a nice piece of hardware, and they've executed so much with relatively what we would consider little horsepower.
Yes. It's relatively little compared to what we see in notebooks. I would say it's not much slower than what you get on a really basic netbook.
Well, so what do you think? A 1.6 gigahertz Atom chip is comparable to an ARM 1 gigahertz A4 chip?
I'd say they're comparable in terms of performance, probably.
But not power consumption,
exactly.
Which is awesome. And it also kind of highlights perhaps some shortcomings in x86 architecture and traditional microprocessor design.
Yes, that is the reason why phones over the past 5 years haven't started implementing x86 architectures, is because x86 has to be so robust and it has to be able to support so many different applications and so many different languages and all kinds of other pieces of hardware that it's kind of bloated in a way that a lot of people associate Microsoft's Windows operating system being bloated compared to Mac OS, so that it can't be as efficient yet. They're getting there. They're getting close. They're getting closer. And also what you're seeing is the ARM architecture, as they add in discrete graphics chips onto that.
They're using the Mali GPU, everyone thinks.
Yeah, that seems...
In the A4.
It's got to be the case, because they're not using anything else Tegra-based, and it's the only other one that's kind of mobile, low power consumption, but can produce on what they're showing in these games. So... You know, I don't know. From a hardware perspective, it's incredibly interesting. There's nothing really super unique about it. I mean, we've seen HTC phone that's coming out next or this year. That's a 4G phone. It has a 1 gigahertz Snapdragon ARM processor.
I'm not going to be commenting on whether or not I think you should buy it or whether or not it's good for computing or whatever. Right. I think there's important things to what it means. I think that there's issues. There's plenty of other shows on this network that have been doing it all week, so that's enough. But
I agree.
I really do love the machined aluminum back. Oh,
see, I covered mine up with a case almost immediately. So
no, I like it from the inside where you can see the tooling and.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I just gotta say, the fact that we've done so much iPad coverage has given me the geek souvenir of a lifetime.
What is that?
That's Steve Wozniak's car.
Oh, that is pretty cool. Made of metal.
So I can die happy now. That's
mine out a lot.
I've met my geek hero.
Cool. Let's talk about some PC-based hardware stuff now. We'll move away from the iPad. Last week when you were saying that I did not come up to see you, I was in Santa Clara doing at an event for professional graphics card, specifically this, actually the review went up last night, the AMD FirePro V8800.
So this is not the professional version of the architecture that's used on the most recent line of AMD consumer grade GPUs.
Exactly. So it's not a consumer card, it's a $1,500 graphics card.
For people who do what?
CAD development, a lot of digital content creation, anything relating to 3D Studio Max, Maya, UGS, any of those types of applications. They are used to paying this much for graphics cards. And I know I always get a lot of questions when we talk about the pro-level cards, especially on the consumer-level shows like this. Yes, the hardware on this card is basically identical to what you get on a Radeon HD 5870.
But this does have a 2 gig frame buffer. Because of market segmentation techniques, they can get more for them.
Right. I mean, there are some slight differences. It has additional connectivity on it for third-party adapters. It has 4 display outputs, four display outputs. They're all full-size DisplayPort connections. It also has a 3D stereoscopic plug on it as well. Let me see if I can change over here to the other camera. You'll see there that kind of round thing. It almost looks like an S-Video port. It's actually for...
Oh, God, please don't tell me. Damn it, I hate S-Video connectors so much. I don't care if it's not S-Video. It's that shape and type where it's friction fit.
Yes.
Where if you sneeze, it falls out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think here at Twit sometimes you see things just go black and the audio still works? It's because Leo kicks something out under the desk.
Well, then hopefully it doesn't happen to everybody. Hopefully Leo doesn't come
out
of everybody.
No, I have to tape everything down.
But it's used for stereoscopic 3D for the high-end professional market where they're used to using 3D to look around.
Medical imaging, drilling for oil.
Exactly. But what we did see that was cool there for the average consumer were some unique Eyefinity demonstrations. Eyefinity obviously being the multi-monitor display technology that they introduced with their 5000 series. And we made a little video that demonstrates two different curved displays. The first one is actually from a company called, what are they called? Scalable, ironically enough. So it's called Scalable, and they use multiple projectors on curved surfaces. Actually, they can do it on flat surfaces too, but curved surfaces such as this screen that we had that was about, I don't know, I'd say a 150-degree screen, 180 if you're standing close enough to it, piece of plexiglass that just would sit on a desk and kind of surround you a little bit. And what they had behind us there, or behind it, were four 1080p projectors. And then those projectors would illuminate the image from the back, and then they had some custom software that would warp the images that were being output appropriately so that they would appear to be scaled correctly.
So this is not the Ostendo curve display?
No, this is different. Similar idea, only this is this. I mean, the Scalable company says they do like if you've ever been in a dome with the whole night sky illuminated above you, that's a lot of how those are working or how those are developed as well. They can do it on any surface, from a flat surface to a complete dome to even a whole sphere. You know, if you want to project different images onto it from the outside, and they just we're talking about essentially how cheaper technology or their solution can be with an Eyefinity graphics card when you can put four or even six graphics or six monitors or six projectors out of a single display or out of a single graphics card. So, you know, like the Eyefinity 6 edition GPU we talked about last week, you could have six projectors hooked up to that card. And, you know, you could hit all kinds of shapes of displays and all kinds of sizes of curved monitors or domes or anything like that. So whereas they used to have very expensive custom hardware solutions to go along with their custom software solutions, now that the hardware solution is becoming much more common, much less expensive, and then just the software to map it is all they're really using.
I can't say I'm too happy about this.
Why is that?
I thought I was the coolest person in town with 3 30-inch displays. Now I can have like surround like 90-inch displays, and I could like put my bed in the middle and just get feeding tubes and be done with it.
Yeah, so that was the second. I think you're probably talking about the Ostendo, which was the second demonstration in this video. This is, they like to say it's the first curved monitor, the first curved display, but if you look back,
If you look back at CRTs, those were all curved, just in a different way.
Curved in the wrong direction. Alienware produced a monitor that looks almost identical to this. And my guess is that this company, Ostendo, is either an offshoot of that, or they bought the IP from Alienware or licensed it from the company that Alienware licensed it from. And it is essentially a one giant monitor. And in that article, we actually have pictures of that as well, if you don't want to show the video.
No, I can even show the video.
Of these three monitors. And each monitor encompasses about a 90-degree field of view. And they're curved. They're curved LCDs, but they're not really LCDs because inside
them... Aren't
they DLP
projectors?
Inside of them, inside each monitor, is four projectors. And that's why in that photo, which you can see, you'll see some lines, like some hard vertical lines.
Yeah.
Those only show up when you are not looking at it at a typical viewing angle.
So if you're sitting there, you don't see that.
If you're sitting in that chair, you do not see those lines.
But if you're actually playing, or if you're taking pictures of it, you will, because you're not...
You're not at the right angle. You're not in the right spot. So right, even in the video, when you see the video, you'll see those lines as I record different parts of it. But when I go sit in the chair with the camera and kind of pan around, you'll see that those lines are not there.
So why don't I roll the video real quick?
Okay.
Welcome to PC Perspective. Today I want to show you a couple of really interesting and cool Eyefinity multi-monitor configurations that I saw at a recent AMD professional graphics meeting. The first one that we're going to show you is actually from a company called Scalable. And this company uses projectors on flat or curved surfaces, and it uses warp and scaling technology in order to produce one seamless image, one seamless desktop, one seamless display. And obviously with the advent of Eyefinity and having three or even up to six monitors on a single card, these types of configurations are becoming more and more common. Let's take a look at that.
Our software blends the output of the projectors. So right now there are four projectors aimed at this screen, each 1080p. So it's a very high total resolution. Because of the new Fire Pro card, we can set up Eyefinity, so it's one giant window instead of four, which is very helpful. But our software, basically, each projector, as it hits the other, it trails off and the other picks up, so it blends into one seamless display. We have a camera there, we project a grid, and there's a feedback.
So at the beginning of this video, they're talking about the scalable version, not the Ostendo version.
Right, so mesh, if you want to and so we could do pretty much any screen you gave us, flat, curved, dome. This is just what we're doing right now. We can also, we're using four at the moment because that's what their card is for, and it really helps to have a full window. But in theory, we could go up to any number if you gave us additional outputs.
So if they made it a...
If they make a video card...
Six display cards.
We can easily do that. If they make a card that gives us 20 outputs...
And from the back of the...
And we'll skip to the...
So what you're looking at here is... world's first curved monitor by Ostendo. Each one of these monitors is 2880 by 900 resolution. What we are showing here is three of these monitors that are tied up together with the latest 8800 card running Eyefinity. So what we are painting as a total resolution here is 8192 by 900. And this is a single input monitor, either DVI or HDMI. What we are using is a DisplayPort to DVI adapter. And what you're looking at is a helicopter simulator called Black Shark. But we can also take a look at Google Earth over here, where you can see that it's a completely immersive experience. And each one of these monitors engages about 90 degrees of your horizontal field of view. And so in this case, you would be looking at close to 270 degrees of field of view, essentially.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, no doubt. And by the way, did you like the shirt I was wearing in that video?
Oh, no, I didn't see it.
It was Darth Vader. It was a silhouette of Darth Vader walking an AT-AT on a leash.
That's an awesome shirt.
Yeah, that's... I was proud of that. I wore it specifically for the video. I figured only geeks and nerds that like stuff like this would appreciate it. So,
pretty sweet. So, you know, from what I saw in that video right there, it looks like the Ostendo monitors are huge. They kind of have a back behind them like about half the size of an old CRT would.
Yep.
Depth wise, for the same amount of surface area, and they have bezels around them. Now, the cool thing was when we were looking at that first one that was called Scalable, that was a complete wraparound experience. There were no goofy lines on it from odd angles, and there were no bezels in the shot.
That's correct.
But even though you don't, and it's also, it looks a little magical, you know, like there's nothing behind it. But of course, there's projectors behind it. And if anything is between the projector and the screen, it's screwed.
Yeah, you have to have the open space for it. You have to have, you know, no one blocking your way, making sure nobody can walk by while you're gaming and all that kind of stuff. But
you know,
definitely
this reminds
cool
me of
either.
Avatar in the cockpit of that ship.
Mm.
Remember they had those wraparound displays?
Yeah. That would be cool. So yeah, I mean, the video is just showing some demonstrations. Obviously, both of these solutions are incredibly expensive, not really meant for the casual gamer. more meant for simulations and professional applications and that kind of stuff. But it gives you an idea of what types of things can happen when we start to get more and more display outputs. You know, we jumped very quickly, I think, in the industry from two outputs being the standard to now we have a card that has six outputs. And, you know, we talked about the Affinity 6 and all that kind of stuff last week. So something very cool I thought was worth showing off. Oh, and by the way, our Affinity 6 video review will be up later today, actually, after lots and lots of Adobe problems. Well, we got this figured out. So if anybody wants to see StarCraft II being played on a 5760 by 2160 screen
and I
on
do.
Six monitors, you do, then I'll be sure to put that on our Twitter feed when it goes live.
Yeah, somebody whose name starts with Leo and ends with Laporte was supposed to give me a StarCraft II invite, but has neglected to do so. So I have no idea how amazing it is.
If anyone in the audience wants
to be cooler than Leo, they should email me a StarCraft II invite.
Let's see, what else you want to talk about?
Let's talk about the 700D, maybe?
Well, let's do that next. So we'll quickly wanted to mention this. Alan's not here, but he hates it when we don't talk about some piece of storage and on the show. The Western Digital Velociraptor 600 gig review was posted. He wrote about it. So what you know about the Velociraptor brand,
those in the Ultimate Gaming Machine. They're the 10,000 RPM kind of traditional spinning disk hard drives are sort of the form factor of a laptop hard drive, but they stick them in this giant heatsink to make them kind of fit in the space of a 3.5-inch desktop hard drive. And they're supposed to be the highest performing speed-wise hard drive that you can buy for the money. And you'll sacrifice some value and some overall size.
Yeah. So they're 2.5-inch drives, but they're thicker, so they won't actually fit in laptops. But that form factor is really meant for the server market. 1U and 2U servers use those a lot. It's a 10,000 RPM as opposed to 7,200 RPM, which is what we see our fastest 1.5 and 2 terabyte hard drives. You know, Velociraptor brand has been around for a long time. It was first just Raptor, and they came with the Velociraptor with the 300 gig model, and that was 2 years ago, I think. Yeah, 2 years ago when the Velociraptor first came out. And when it came out, it was the fastest hard drive you could buy. It wasn't the largest hard drive you could buy by far in terms of capacity, but it was definitely the fastest. Since then, SSDs have quickly overtaken it in terms of performance, but are still lagging behind in capacity. So, you know, you're still stuck at, you know, let's say 160 gigs for a reasonable price on an SSD, whereas this new Velociraptor 600 gig drive acquaints itself with being the fastest spindle-based hard drive, because even the 2 terabyte standard 7200 RPM hard drives had proven to be faster.
Those
than
were like the RE4 drives.
Yeah, I mean, just because of the mathematics of platter density, they became faster than the 300 gig Velociraptor. So the 600 gig version doubles its platter density, and because of that, we see it overtake any other spindle-based hard drive in terms of performance. And it's relatively cheap compared to SSDs. The 600 gig model will sell for about $329, and that comes out to about 55 cents per gigabyte. Whereas on an SSD, you're doing well if you're getting $3 to $3.50 per gigabyte. So there's a big difference there. Speed difference obviously still goes to the SSD, but if you want, you know, the fastest spindle drive you can buy, but you still need, you know, 500, 600 gigs of storage, then you have another option with these newer Velociraptor offerings.
Now, I hear that, you know, really high performance traditional spindle drives beat most of the SSDs out there in sequential read speeds. Versus random read speeds. I hear that from some sources.
I would say that's not true.
Okay.
Now, sequential writes are a different question.
Is it maybe different thing? What I'm confusing
because the Intel, even the Intel G2 SSD has a 100 megabyte per second or so limit to its write speeds. But even though we believe that's an artificial limit through BIOS and that kind of stuff, or through firmware. That being said, the Velociraptor drive gets above that 120, 130. sustained write speed. So that's where it has an advantage. Although I think with the right drive at the right, with the right firmware,
downhill,
the SSDs
tailwind.
Are going to be faster. Yeah, on either side. So
who would benefit most from this hard drive that we're talking about right now, the Velociraptor?
If you are a user that requires more than 150, 160 gigs for your operating, for your primary drive, if you don't want to deal with the hassle of just installing Windows and just installing certain applications on your SSD because it's a 40 gig or an 80 gig model to stay within your price bracket, then for $300 you can get a 600 gig Velociraptor. It's going to be really, really fast. It's not going to be as fast as an SSD, but it's going to be the fastest spindle-based drive. Then that's what you can go for. You know, that's something like I would consider getting, actually it's a really good idea, I just thought about it, getting a set of these to replace.
Whoa, I've just realized I'm brilliant.
I'm a genius. I'm going to replace our 300 gig Velociraptor RAID 5 configurations in our video editing servers with 600 gig ones. Double your storage for a reasonable cost. So we can get 600 gigs. No, we can get 1.2 gigs or 1.2 terabytes of storage in our RAID 5 configuration for about $900. Whereas you will not even get close to that with SSDs.
Interesting.
So that's an instance where you would want to use these drives. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to have to order those today.
Or if you had insane amounts of money, you could, you know, buy five of them and build a RAID array and have one of the fastest spindle-based, relatively large-sized RAID arrays you can get.
You know, with a good RAID controller, yeah. I mean, it'll be fast for that.
Now, does this one have the backplate where the SATA power and data ports are in the same location in a 3.5-inch bay for hot swapping?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. So, yeah, the problem with the first 300-gig Velociraptor was that it wouldn't work in hot swap bays. They had a second revision that came out that fixed that. These are straight from the right from the start support hot swap bays.
Very cool. So even if you wanted to, buy a SAN, for example, you could fill one in with, all the RAID boxes up with it. That's really cool.
Yep. Now, after our storage fix, I do want to talk about just quickly about how awesome these glasses are. And I guess their batteries are dead. But these are, Colleen, I'm assuming you do.
Those are 3D glasses.
These are 3D glasses.
Of course,
they're so awesome.
You should know, when you search Google for Ryan Shrout, the first image that comes up is actually wearing 3D glasses.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And Leo says you're beautiful with them.
Well, I thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. So these are the NVIDIA 3D Vision 3D glasses, actually.
Which are active shutter glasses.
These are active shutter glasses.
They're the ones that you always go up to the store to try out 3D Vision and they're always broken.
Unfortunately, that appears to be the case. But this technology came out, I don't know, it's been more than a year, I guess. It came out right when we were starting to do this show, actually. So maybe 18 months ago or something like that. Obviously, it requires an NVIDIA graphics card. It requires a new driver, but this hardware and it requires 120 hertz LCD panel,
which is twice the refresh rate of a typical LCD.
Right, and when I say 120 hertz, I mean 120 hertz input. So you can't get one of those
Costco
Vizio
TVs. That's saying,
yeah, yeah. That's all marketing. That's all for different kind of image quality.
It does interpolation, not true.
Right. So this is actually 60 hertz per eye. So 60 frames per second per eye. And the reason I brought this up today is because it's very exciting. I'm sure everybody's enthralled by it. The Masters golf tournament is being shown in 3D. And I don't know if this is the first major sports broadcast in 3D. But what's interesting about it is Comcast is behind it. They were, had this link up. Robert Heron
really
was
golf in 3D.
And actually kind of cool. We were watching it earlier, and there's the problem.
It's not cool. It's golf. My dad plays golf. Have you met my dad?
No, not yet.
He wears colored shirts every day, and
I have colored shirts on almost every day. Well, every day I'm on TV with you, at least. So, but you're right. I mean, it's not the most exciting thing in the world, but for golf fans, it's actually pretty cool. But one of the things you can do with golf landscapes in terms of showing off 3D effects is that we were watching a shot where it was a par three and it was a straight shot straight across and you got a lot of depth perception going from, the golfer to the hole to where the pin is and all that kind of stuff. And they did some zooming in on that. And all the 3D effects actually worked pretty well. All three of us in the office that tried it out today were, I think, surprisingly impressed by it. The downside is if you want to do it, if you have a 3D Vision ready laptop or 3D Vision ready PC, you can just go to masters.com/3D and it'll show you how
so
to get set up.
So this is streaming video to your computer in 3D with NVIDIA 3D glasses.
Correct.
So and is this flash?
No, you have a specific 3D video player provided by NVIDIA that came with your driver and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, now I'm amused because remember how they just came out with the GTX 460 and 470 and I was totally making fun of them for live blogging the event rather than streaming it?
Yes.
The reason that I was given from NVIDIA was, it's difficult to stream 3D and we were trying to show off 3D.
It's very
difficult. That's exactly what this is.
Right, and it's very difficult and because they recommend a 10 megabit downstream connection.
Hey, whatevs, I got that.
Well, I know you do. We had trouble here, and we typically have 15.
Everyone?
We typically have 15 to 20. So, I mean, what they're doing is they're giving you five megabits per eye, right? So, I mean, it's switching, and my guess is, I'm just guessing here, a 10 megabit stream is splitting that between your left eye and your right eye. Hopefully it's doing some interpolation, so it doesn't need to. I don't really want to get into that, but it worked pretty well. The resolution wasn't as great because it is streaming video as opposed to coming over, you know, your cable box and that kind of stuff. So it was, you know, sometimes it got a little grainy. It was choppy because we were having trouble getting a steady 10 megabit stream of bandwidth from wherever Comcast servers are that were running this. But when it worked well, it actually was pretty cool, and I think what's going to have to happen is more of these demonstrations are going to need to be created. People are going to have to be able to go see this stuff in person. You know, I don't know if this is the case, but I would hope if you go to a Best Buy store today that they are showing the 3D version of the Masters playing on their 3D TVs with glasses.
I know if I went to a Fry's right now and I went up to the NVIDIA 3D booth and I put on the glasses and I was going to check out Tomb Raider and that it just wouldn't work. I'd be missing an arm on the glasses and one of them would be missing. And
yeah, that's true. People are not the most careful with stuff that is not their own. But, you know, it's a lot of people, we talk about 3D TV hype and all sorts of kind of stuff, but at least here they're giving you free content to try out and see if you want to buy it. Now, unfortunately, there are probably a lot of people that have already bought the TVs and they're like just starving for something to actually show off.
It's like when we got HD TVs for the first time and there was that one Discovery HD channel.
Yeah, exactly.
That just had like a helicopter flying over Ireland for 7 years. And,
right.
And we're like, wow.
Right. But you still, HD. But now you see how things have progressed.
Right.
You know, how many HD channels do we actually have now?
Now we have Comedy Central in HD, which is a complete waste because everything takes place in the 4x3 space and the rest is all just excess crap.
Right. Agreed. A lot of channels do that. But, I mean, every sport is in HD. I mean, when the first Super Bowl was in high definition, that was a huge deal.
And now
it's
just,
if it's not in HD, I almost get angry and I want to throw things at the TV. So if you have any, if you're one of the few people that have a 3D vision set up, like I said, go to masters.com/3D. Even if you're not a golf fan, try it out and see if you're impressed at all. I'll be curious to see if anybody has any feedback.
It's actually probably pretty cool. And I'd like, if anyone knows where I can go take a look at it so I can actually give an honest review, then I'll...
You don't have any 3D vision set up?
Me?
You don't have any friends that have 3D vision?
No.
Can't believe that.
Who would I... I mean, Scott Wilkinson is in Los Angeles. I could hit him up to go take a look at it, but...
It's only a six-hour drive.
Does you know sometimes NVIDIA does like parties at their place where they show stuff off?
Yeah.
I wonder if they're doing anything there. I could go down and check it out.
You could see, hopefully, if NVIDIA were smart and they're listening, they would have, you know, maybe like a publicly available areas where they had 3D vision setups showing off the Masters in 3D for people to just come up and watch. Could be at local malls, local Fry's. Maybe they're that smart. Maybe they're doing that.
Maybe they're not.
But let's talk about our last item of the day. This is the one I know you've been itching to get towards. This is the Corsair 700D. I don't know. It's not for sale yet. I was told it'd be available in about 2 weeks or so.
And that was 6 weeks ago.
No. This was just today. I talked to him. 2 weeks before they become fresh off the boat, so to speak, in from China.
Whoa, dude. Whoa.
You're familiar with the 800D.
Right, which is a really cool case. It's huge, and you can mount a radiator to it, and it's got hot swap drives in it, and it's beautiful and well-constructed.
So the 700D is essentially the same case with a couple of modifications.
Okay, one, what are the modifications?
No hot swappable hard drive bays. Okay. No window on the side panel. Those are the two major changes.
Neither of which I care about losing.
Right, and that's why they made this case, because they're going to sell it for about $50 less than the 800D because of the subtraction of those features.
Now, I actually consider it a positive, because if you look at the 800D, mm-hmm. everything on it is a right angle. It's this black monolith.
Yes.
But if you look at the window on the side, it's got this weird kind of Burj Al Arab hotel, you know, sailboat looking thing angle.
Right. Well, I think that's more meant as a, because their name is Corsair. It is a boat, has sails on it. It's probably maybe the idea.
Whatever. It's ugly and I don't want it. But if I buy the 700D,
you don't have to worry
about it. I don't have to have it. And I save $50.
You save $50. Let me see if I can switch here. So I have a 700D sitting here with me. Obviously, it's big and heavy, so I can't exactly pick it up and show it to everybody. But
this
is
a big case. Let's get that out of the way. It's really not in any way.
So this portable. I mean, it's a huge case. You can see here, it's a huge case. Up here, the motherboard section actually stops right about here, and this whole area up here is what Colleen loves. You can put three internally mounted 120mm fans or a triple radiator with three fans on it as well,
or a triple radiator internal. With six fans on it.
Sure, you can do that. Put them above, the top, and below. You can do that.
Make it sound like it's going to take off.
Some of the cool features about this case. These rubber grommets that you see all around here.
Awesome
wire management. Easy to use.
Huge.
An idiot could do this and make their case look great.
That's the number one thing to building a PC and making it look good is wire management.
Yes, exactly. Now, I kind of missed the window on the 700D a little bit because it shows off how clean everything looks inside, even though you had nothing to do with it. It was all the case itself. But regardless, the key is that when you get inside your case to change something, to check on something, to upgrade a component, it's going to be clean. It's going to be easy to remove cables and move things out of the way so you can get a video card in or out, whatever it is. And this works because the power supply that sits down here, you can't see it, sits underneath here. All the cables for it come up behind the motherboard and come out through these grommets. And then you just, you know, you take them out at the spot where it's most convenient. So there's as little cable showing as possible. Same thing with the SATA cables that come from these hard drive bays that go around the back and come in through these grommets. It all is very clean. The other big feature is you see this giant square here. That is a removable back panel so that you can change your CPU heatsink without having to take your motherboard out.
So I've seen removable motherboard trays. And so, for example, if I wanted to change a water block on my CPU, mm-hmm. I'd have to take the motherboard tray out, remove the motherboard from the tray, mm-hmm. change the back panel, and put it back on. With this, is the motherboard tray removable and there's a back panel so I don't have to remove the whole thing just to change the heatsink?
No, the motherboard panel is fixed.
Okay.
It's not removable. But what you do is you take the back off of the case, and then this panel, I can't really do it because of the way it's laying down. It opens up. You can take it off or turn it down so that you are shown the back of the motherboard. So then you can unscrew
in the CPU area. Backplate.
Yes. And that's why they made it so big. I would say almost all motherboards are going to have their processor fit in this area. The first iteration of the 800D that reviewed had a much smaller square. They fixed that in the actual reselling revision of the 800D, and then the 700D, of course, kept the larger version.
That's so this really means, cool.
Yeah, it's nice because when you don't have to take out your graphics cards, you don't have to unhook any cables or anything like that. You can just swap out the heatsink or
add
a wall.
Yeah, if I want to change the heatsink on my computer, I'd have to take the whole damn thing apart.
Yeah. Now, because we don't have hot swap bays, we do have these new kind of drive trays. They're kind of, the only reason they're kind of cool is that they're toolless. You know, so I just took the hard drive out. There's these little rubber washers that have little stubs, little nubs in them so that they you don't need screws. And it just fits in there like that and then slides back into place. Almost everything is toolless. If you want to install a 2.5-inch SSD in these, you can do that, of course, but you have to use screws. They're not toolless in that way. But all the 5.25-inch bays are toolless.
But you can. I mean, there's a lot of cases out there like mine. There's really no good way to install a 2.5-inch drive unless you put a 2.5 into a 3.5 adapter.
Right. And so you've got a 140-millimeter fan back here. You've got a 120-millimeter fan bringing up air from the power supply area. You've got this removable 140-millimeter fan as well that brings air up into the hard drive section of the case. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on here. There's a lot of easy-to-access parts to it. So, you know, it really is basically the same case. Basically the same case, minus the hot swap bays.
Still awesome, but cheaper.
It's $50 cheaper. It's still expensive for a case. It's going to be $229, $230, you know, something like that.
But that's a price before it was too expensive. And let's be honest, I love my Antec P180, but mm-hmm. I've taken many, many tools to that thing to cut holes in it, to screw things to it.
Right.
And it's time for it to be retired. And I think, you know, I really wanted an 800D, but I couldn't really justify it. And this is right at the $200 price point where I think that's an acceptable price for a good case. And that's actually the case I might buy.
In a couple of weeks, you will be able to do that. So we'll actually have, we just finished a video review of this. It's just ready to be uploaded as soon as we're done with our show tonight. And so that'll be available probably tomorrow as well. So if everybody wants to go to PCPro.com, we should have that video review up as well. You want to have time hit up a few Twitter questions real quick?
Absolutely.
Let's do that.
So let me take a look at the Google Doc here.
Sure.
Twitch 65 show notes. So let's put us in a little double box action here.
Let's do that.
Put me in the double box. Wiki, 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 wow. And look at that lower third. All right. Lazy Guru 909 would like to ask, do we really need Core 2 Quad or Core i7 to run Battlefield Bad Company 2 or better, or for better performance? Yes, you do.
I'm not sure what he's starting with, though. So, I mean, if he has a Core 2 Duo now and he's asking about going to a Core 2 Quad, I would say don't bother.
It depends on the Core 2 Duo that you have. You'd need a really fast one.
It's kind of iffy. If he has, you know, the ability to upgrade to a Core i7 like a Nehalem or a Linfield,
you'll want to.
Then you'll want to, yes. So, you know, you could get a Core i7 860 and a new motherboard, but you might have to get a new motherboard, new memory, you know, all that kind of stuff along with it. So make sure you put that into consideration there. But I don't think it's necessarily necessary, I guess. To say it in an incorrect manner.
I don't know. It seems like a
Bad Company 2 hasn't been shown to be really highly threaded in terms of CPU usage. I still think it might be a GPU issue if he's trying to get better performance out of it.
I thought they were actually advertising that they were highly threaded for quad cores.
No, I hadn't heard about Bad Company 2.
Advertising in real life is two different things.
Well, yeah, always is.
I defer to you on this one.
Okay. So who do we have next?
So what was your final answer?
I would say you don't need to. But I mean, if he's coming from like an Athlon 64, the answer is yes. If he's coming from a Core 2 Duo that's of reasonable speed, then, you know, if you can get a cheap Core 2 Quad that's the same frequency, I mean, you can get this for $120 and your motherboard supports it, go ahead and swap it in. But I would say, you know, without more information about what graphics card he's using and that kind of stuff, I lean towards the graphics card being the performance problem.
Oh, no, I lean towards your drivers and the buggy piece of crap software that it is being the problem.
I thought you fixed all that.
I did, but, you know, mostly. It's
fair enough.
There's other people who that driver update might not fix. It's buggy. I don't. Anyway.
Anyway.
Salty69UK. I'm going to mark that to be edited out. Wants to know, is it possible to upgrade the graphics adapter in a new iMac? I imagine it to be difficult, but is it possible?
No.
Whoa. It's theoretically possible, assuming you are Apple, you have vast resources, and yes, can do a new production line of about 50,000.
Exactly.
Oh, are you a home user?
Unless that guy is Steve Jobs or one of his lackeys, then the answer is probably no.
No, not a chance.
Sorry.
So,
next.
Andy1633 would like to know, I just installed an Asus HD5770 Q-Core into my PC, but the Windows Experience Index window tells me it's DX10.
I'm assuming he's installed it in Windows 7, not Windows Vista. If it's Windows Vista, that's why. If in Windows 7, my guess is just a software issue. I mean, if you have a 5770, it's 100% DX11 ready graphics card. And as long as you have drivers, ATI drivers that support the 5770, which you better. I mean, hopefully you've downloaded and installed the Catalyst 10.3s that are out there. Then I wouldn't worry about what Windows Experience Index is telling you about your gaming
hardware. That's a meaningless feature anyway.
Yeah.
So open up a DX11 game and see if it works in DX11 mode.
Yeah, turn on DX11 mode, see if it says no.
And if not, reinstall your drivers. But your hardware is DX11, and if you're running Vista or 7, you're DX11 compatible.
Well, not Vista necessarily, unless you download.
Oh, really?
I think the DX11 patch. Like, DX11 came out with Windows 7, and it was later ported to Windows Vista.
Right,
so.
But you could run DX11 on Windows Vista if it's configured correctly.
Yes. You have to download DX update for it, but yeah.
NTman68 would like to know, what's the best PCIe card for gaming but doesn't take two slots or have crazy power requirements?
Finding a graphic card that doesn't require two slots nowadays is getting really, really difficult.
Assuming you're not water cooling.
Right. Well, assume he's not going to water cool, because then you could essentially get anything. The last one I remember being very happy with is the Galaxy GeForce GTX 260 Plus. It was a single slot card, and it was slightly overclocked. Last time I looked, that card is very hard to get a hold of. It's just hard to find for sale anywhere. We did a review of it at PCPro.com, so if you go look through our graphics card section, you'll be able to find it and read all about the performance and power requirements and that kind of stuff. Other than that,
the GTX 260 Plus from Galaxy is what you're saying?
Yes.
It looks like a two slot design.
There was one that was a single slot.
Okay. Let me look for that one.
Yeah. Other than that, you're going to have to go further down the performance scale. So maybe something like the Radeon 5750.
Oh, it's the Razer edition.
Yeah, the Razer edition. And so, see, it makes sense now. Razer, thin, one slot, right, not two. You know, you're just going to have to go farther down the performance scale. I want to say GTX 275s. I know there's probably none of those that are single slot either. 9800 GT, if you want to go live back in 2004 or something, 2006, whenever those cards came out. I mean,
not a bad exaggerating, card,
but no, not a bad card. But if he's looking for something for today that does gaming today, it's going to be more difficult to find a single slots card. If you go to like newegg.com, I think you can sort by how many slots they take up. So that'd be a nice feature to look at.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Razer edition is probably the best bet that I've heard of. I didn't even realize they made any single slot 260s.
Yeah, I think it's hard to find. I think somebody has asked me that or emailed me trying to find one of those, and they couldn't do it, and they were trying to buy mine off of me. So
if you go into that much effort, it might be easier just to figure out how to make a two slot.
Yeah, how to make a two slot card computer work. Exactly. So there you go. That is all of our Twitter questions for today. If you want to submit some for next week, just follow me at Ryan Shrout on Twitter, and or you can follow Colleen, and you are
at Digital Kitty.
Okay, that's going to wrap up this week in computer hardware for this week, I guess. And anything else we want to talk about? We talked about everything.
There's new Drobos.
New and exciting. There are new Drobos. I think we talked about those a couple of weeks ago, though.
The
FS model.
You talked about the Drobo FS a couple of weeks ago?
I think so. Alan did. Yeah.
The embargo just ended yesterday.
Well, then we screwed up on something. But no, this is the one that was the first gigabit networking, right?
No.
At a network port.
Yes, it has a network port, as do all other Drobos. Well,
oh, okay.
Not all, but so what the Drobo FS is, from my understanding, is that it's a it's more of a NAS device. It doesn't use iSCSI as the protocol to connect, like the Drobo Elite or the Drobo Pro. The Drobo Pro being iSCSI from one Drobo to a one computer client, and then Drobo Elite being multiple iSCSI clients on a single Drobo. Drobo FS being a dual ARM processor Drobo, right, that works over NFS, you know, network file system.
Yep.
And so I think you can do SMB, AFB, and basically it's just a NAS, and it does about 80 megabytes a second. And Alan's in the chat room if you want to get him on.
Alan posted it on Tuesday, April 6th about it. So no, I was wrong about last week. Just earlier this week. My days have been going long. So it seems like it's been a week.
So basically it's a consumer grade NAS Drobo with 5 ports. Cool. That looks like it's pretty badass. I haven't gotten my hands on one, but I'm excited.
We'll have to see if Alan gets his hands on one to do some testing as well. So other than that, we got our obligatory news post up this week. So
all right.
That's it. If you want to find me, I run and operate PC Perspective at pcper.com, as well as doing This Week in Computer Hardware on this network. Also, make sure if you're listening, you stay a little bit later, 10 p.m. tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern time. We'll be recording the PC Perspective podcast back on once again at its normal time. So with that, I'm Ryan Shrout.
I'm Colleen Kelly.
And this has been This Week in Computer Hardware.